Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. This is Donna Freed, and today I am with Liz Foley and Beth Coates, who jointly wrote, What Would Boudica Do? Everyday Problems Solved by History's Most Remarkable Women. Welcome, Beth.
Hello.
And welcome, Liz.
Hi.
So, what would Boudica do? The first thing that I thought of is that phrase, what would Jesus do, you know, and sort of to guide your daily lives. And personally, it's a hell of a lot more badass to say, what would Boudica do?
Yeah.
Usually, I think the answer would be kick your ass. But
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, for us, we took the kind of inspiration from the phrase, what would Beyonce do? Which is, so she's our other Queen Bee, the Queen Boudica. So we were always imagining it as a much more badass approach to life, kind of dealing with the modern problems that get flung at us the whole time and thinking, what's a good stand-up way to deal with that? And how can these women, through history, teach us new and inventive ways to go?
But it's true, Boudica would probably set fire to everything as a response to any kind of...
Not a measured response. However, okay, so, but what are the problems? Talk me through it. What are the problems that Boudica would solve?
So we have Boudica on Sticking Up For Yourself. So she's an interesting one for that because she was very deeply injured and shamed by the Romans taking over her territory, raping her daughters, and in a completely unjust way. And instead of, as would be expected, you know, allowing that to happen and letting the Romans triumph, she went on a wild rampage of setting fire to several cities. And you can still see in London a layer of the ash from where she burned everything here. And that, although we are not endorsing murder as a correct response to somebody taking your stuff, we do think that she's a good example of standing up for yourself. And a lot of the problems that we find that women come across are about assertiveness, about being heard, about being listened to. And Boudica, we think, is a really good kind of shining light for that issue of standing up for yourself and stepping outside your lane, outside of what people expect of you, and taking back what's yours.
Bringing a little bit of badass Boudica to the boardroom.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so tell me about the structure of the book. You have 50 women. You just chose 50.
Yeah, well, that was kind of one of the hardest things, actually. We have this, we have these extraordinary spreadsheets of, like, spare ladies, because obviously it's really hard to hone down these. Just, you know, when you start, you go down these rabbit holes of amazing women, and there are definitely loads of women who we regret not putting in. But we wanted to keep it at 50. We wanted it to be accessible. We wanted it to be for people to pick it up, to dip in, to dip out. We wanted as well to have a really good spread. You know, we work in books, so our kind of initial compulsion was to do writers and artists and photographers, but we were really keen that we wanted scientists and mathematicians and explorers and poets as well. Of course, there are a lot of writers in there,
sports people,
yeah, also basically across the kind of spectrum of both history and kind of disciplines as well. So we had to, we had to lose a lot of people that we feel very sad about, but I think we've got a good, really good mix of 50 women.
We feel very guilty about Marie Curie.
Yeah.
And about Joan of Arc.
Yeah.
Well, on the other hand, those are examples that we know of. And sort of like any stereotype, we're inured to the message. So you've tied each of these women, so in some cases surprisingly, for the person it is, to the attribute you have tied them to. As we said, Boudica for standing up for yourself. Queen Victoria is in there for getting over loss.
Yes.
And I thought that was an interesting one. Tell me a little bit about that one.
Well, so she's always seen as this kind of, you know, bastion of empire and strength and et cetera. But I think not even just watching that incredible TV program that was on recently, but you get the sense of her interior life and this love between her and Albert. And it was really interesting researching that one, the kind of grief, the sort of dark place that she went to. But all the, you know, there's the stuff with her gilly in Scotland and the ways that she managed to pull herself out of it as well, which were just fascinating. And I mean, okay, she took grief to another level, we have to say, like, it was 15 years of wearing black and mourning, and I think at one point her government were getting seriously worried about whether she could carry on because she was so sad. But eventually, you know, she realized she had to pull herself out of it. And I don't know, she just, the idea of these taking yourself off to places, the big open spaces of Scotland, we felt that that was kind of achievable. Even just take yourself for a walk, go to the beach, kind of, you know, Allow yourself to grieve, exactly. All of this.
Maybe not take 15 years.
No, maybe not 15 years, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
She did everything real, real big.
Yeah.
You know, she's like, I want a summer home. I'll take Africa.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So, yeah, she did everything a little bit, you know, larger than, larger than the rest of us.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple more that I really wanted to go through, especially... towards the end of the book, I found I was sort of more drawn to the older women.
Yeah.
Somehow. Enhedwana. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's her name. And you, hers was the attribute of finding your creativity.
Yeah, Enhedwana. So she, again, she's one of those a bit like Sappho where there's very little kind of evidence based around her because she is ancient times. She's essentially, though, the first writer. Because she's the first person, man or woman, that we have record of writing. So that in itself is kind of extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And then actually when you sort of go into the poems that are there, they're really personal. And she's talking about I am Enhedwana, which I kept thinking about my children being obsessed with Moana. But it's that thing of it's the owning your kind of self as a creative source. And that seemed to me amazing that she was doing it millennia before Homer, say, which,
And she's really, so little known as
and
well.
And she's so little known. But there are these brilliant kind of depictions of her leading these men all supplicant at her feet, which really tickled us too.
Yeah, we wanted to get a mixture of famous people and people that you might not have heard of. And we discovered so many people, as Beth said, when we were going through trying to get down to the 50. But part of why we have the ones we have is because we were finding people who matched particular problems. Mm. So that was, you know, some of the more famous people who perhaps are obvious omissions didn't necessarily have an issue that it would be useful to explore through the book. So,
yes, and also, like, someone who I am super ashamed to say that I don't know because I went to Vassar College was Grace Hopper.
Lovely Grace Hopper, amazing Grace. She's amazing.
She is.
I loved her. I love the stories about her kind of refusing to give up and taking apart those alarm clocks when she was a 7-year-old. And, you know, I don't know where anyone else, you just say, well, I want a new one. But she kind of put it back together 8 or 9 times until she got it right. She's such a great example of just keeping on going even when the odds are stacked against you. And I think when Pearl Harbor occurred in America, she was just determined that she was going to go and join the effort, despite the fact that she was far too small and far too old, I think.
Yeah,
she was 34.
Yeah, she was
34.
They didn't want her.
They didn't want
this incredibly gifted woman.
Yeah, this amazing mathematician. So she went in, and the manual that she wrote for that computer, I mean, it's sort of staggering. And I just love the legacy of all these warships named after this teeny little firecracker of a woman. It's great. She's great.
Tell me, so one of the other ones that I thought, as an American woman, I had just absorbed the message and moved on. And then I moved here and it was so weird. And I am talking about Sheila Michaels, who popularized in America being called Ms. Mm. That you do not have to reveal your marital status along with your name. Mm. And I do it here all the time, and people think it's really weird.
Oh, do they?
It's tantamount to young women admitting to being a feminist. They're like, it just means you're an old maid.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, it's an odd one still, it is. And actually, in that chapter, we talk about the kind of history of how these designations came about. And actually, the history isn't straightforward either in terms of what you were actually saying about yourself. If you were saying Mrs. in the old days, or if you were saying Miss, I think at some point Miss essentially meant you were a prostitute.
Yeah. Yes, it was a sort of code.
Yes.
So, Sheila was an interesting one for us to find out about because it was actually her death, I think, is when I first found out about her because of the obituaries about her and about how she came across that term through a Marxist magazine that she'd received, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And the Marxists had a solution to something that actually had been bothering her for lots of personal reasons, but obviously has bothered women for a long time.
Yeah, and it's something that I grew up in and around New York. It was just, but of course, like,
really?
And I've kept my maiden name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, and it's so funny because I did say to my husband, people will call me, you know, Mrs. Schminkerding, Broken Schminkerding, you know. You know, they'll call, when we moved to England, I bet you they'll call you, oh, is this Mrs. Schunk?
They can't pronounce
his last name. That's why I call this Schminkerding. But I was like, there's enough people who call me that anyway. Yeah. Like, I don't, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it is just the assumptions, the sort of cultural assumptions.
Mm.
And until you examine them, and why, or if you're adversely affected by it.
Yes.
I think that's when we notice stereotypes.
Yeah, yeah.
If it doesn't affect you, you're like, what's the problem?
Yeah, norm is the norm.
The norm.
Yeah.
It's just the norm. It's just cultural. And then it affects you. You're like, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah. But it's interesting. I sort of feel like that with young women, people of our generation have always called themselves feminist, but it seems to me that young women are now really re-embracing that term.
Yes, and after a period of it being something people are a little bit more cautious around, and certainly lots of celebrities are always
code
like,
for strident.
Yeah, exactly. But it seems more like people are coming back around to that thing and keeping your maiden name, or at least in a workplace being easy about keeping your maiden name. That feels like it's coming back around, thank God.
There certainly was a thing where, like, my mother is very like, oh, this is so confusing. I'm like, well, how is it more confusing for me to take someone else's name than it is for me to just keep the name that I've had for, you know,
and the one you gave me.
So it's just,
although it was given to us by our fathers, that's the only thing where I trip up on it. It's my father's name, I have not my mother's name.
Exactly.
So, anyway.
You could go back and keep going back generations, get the grandmothers.
There are countries where it's just completely not the, as you were saying earlier, it's not the norm to take your husband's name at all.
Mm-hmm. Oh. I know two people that the children have the mother's name.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So just different things. Yeah. Okay. So hard questions here. Favorites. Beth?
Okay, my favorite, I think, is Isabella Beaton. I like the subject, imposter syndrome. It's definitely something I struggle with. I find it very hard to turn off that little inner voice that's always saying, you're just about to be found out. But I also like the fact that she is somebody who completely upended my sort of expectations. I had this image in my head of her being this matronly woman, kind of stalking the corridors of a huge country house and screaming at the servants with pies coming out of everywhere. In fact, she was this really young, enterprising journalist and editor. She was married to a publisher who had the idea for this column, and she ran with it, even though she was a really dreadful cook by all accounts. I think she plagiarized a lot of her recipes. I think the first one she left out flour or something and had to print an apology. But she just kind of kept going, and she's still today. And also she did all of this in her early 20s. She died in her 20s as well. So she was just, for me, a really nice sort of pairing of subject and woman who was not who I thought she was. So yeah, she's my
favorite. You had that whole...
Completely, yeah.
Experience.
Yeah.
With her.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So she's my favourite, I think.
And Liz?
I find this really hard to choose, but I pick Caroline Hazlitt. So she's someone who I didn't know anything about at all. And her chapter is Caroline Hazlitt and giving up housework, which again is a topic close to my heart. But she essentially was an engineer at a time where women weren't engineers. And she was involved in the electrification of Britain after the war. And as part of that, her mission was to free women from the incredibly laborious work with the mangle, work with the duster. She wanted there to be plug points everywhere so that people could have a easier life and do something different, like study engineering, rather than constantly be cleaning the pelmets. Mm. And she's also, one of the reasons I like her is because she's one of the quieter ones. So we have a lot of women in this book who are obviously outliers, who are obviously larger-than-life characters like Josephine Baker or like Cleopatra. Mm. But Caroline Hazlitt is a twin set and pearls kind of lady who did these extraordinary things. She invented, I think, safety plugs as well, so that if your children stick their fingers in the sockets, they don't get electrocuted. So significant things, but we're in quite a quiet way.
Mm. Fantastic. One of the things I really liked about your book is because it is a very light-handed feminist historical manifesto as a collection.
Oh,
you know?
Thank you.
And so you're not, you know what I mean? We're doing it. We're not saying we're doing it, but it just happens to be. It also gives a really positive, hopeful message to me that all was never lost and all will never be lost.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Women have been doing this for sort of millennia. Yeah.
As long as there have been women. Yeah. They've been doing it.
And they've been surmounting things. And I think, again, writing this book made us really grateful to live now, where things have, you know, sometimes it feels like we're going backwards. And actually, we are in so much of a better place than a lot of the women that we were writing about.
But it's still good to keep thinking about it and keep kind of taking the lessons from the past and remember and, you know, making sure we're aware of their legacy and sort of acting on that the whole time as well.
I would say, have you been personally inspired and put into practice?
Well, I always come back to that punchy public speaking by Elizabeth I, because it's not something I completely enjoy, but there are definitely elements there of, like, do we say have a good drink beforehand?
Yes.
Don't imagine everyone naked, because that's going to really distract you. But there are certain
and
kind
grand dramatic gestures and thinking about your wardrobe.
Yeah,
because when she gave her amazing speech, she was wearing a, I think, white velvet gown like a breastplate. So she was actually hearkening purposefully back to Boudicca to give this impression of herself as a war leader, as all her troops were waiting to meet the armada.
Yeah, yeah.
And we haven't gone and done presentations in white velvet and breastplates
not yet.
But
I'm
you know,
saying,
keeping the
thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
What would Beyonce
do? Yeah,
exactly. I'm thinking she would.
Yeah, exactly.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Liz Foley and Beth Coates. The book is What Would Boudicca Do? Everyday Problems Solved by History's Most Remarkable Women. And for more remarkable women, go to radiogorgeous.com.